Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Synapse, Think Tank of the Air, featuring influencers, creatives, and thought leaders in the Twin Cities. And now, here is our host, Steve LeBall.
And welcome to another edition of Synapse Think Tank of the Air. We're on a field trip today in a remote location in Minneapolis at the home of Scott Edelstein, who is, I kind of think of him as a peer just because of a lot of the things that he does. He's currently a writing and publishing consultant, but he's been all kinds of things. He's a writer, editor, ghostwriter, and has a past, maybe an active past as a literary agent. So how are you doing, Scott?
I'm very glad to be here. It's a pleasure to be on Synapse with you.
Great, great. And, I actually just was doing some research lately because, you know, I'm a ghostwriter. That's how I make, some steady income. And I was reading that in 2017 was the first year they had 1 million titles published by self-publishing authors. And I think most of those, about all except for about 120,000, were printed books, and the rest were e-books. And so it seems like there's more books than ever before. And even in the commercial world, I read that newspapers and magazines are dropping left and right, but books are staying strong. So how long have you been in the publishing industry so that you can give some perspective on this?
Sure. Well, I started in publishing really back when I was a teenager. I started writing for magazines when I was still in high school.
That was 20 years ago?
Yeah, that was around, it was in the early 1970s. So it was a bit of a time ago, and so I've seen a few changes in the industry. Of course, it is actually multiple industries, right? There is magazine publishing, newspaper publishing, newsletter publishing, strictly online publishing, book publishing, and then all of these things overlap. And the even what's called self-publishing has in some ways changed and in some ways not. So if you go back to the early days of book publishing, when you think about, say, the early 1700s in London, when the first two novels were published by Richardson, they were Pamela and Clarissa. Why did he get to publish the first two things that were called novels in the English language? It's because he owned a printing press. And so back then, the center of English language publishing was London, and it was run by people who had their own printing press. And so then as the more and more organizations and people got access to printing presses, then we saw the rise of mainstream book publishing and so on. And now we've kind of come full circle to where publishing and distribution can be in anybody's hands. And so we're back to, if you have access to either a printing press or the ability to post something online, you can be your own publisher again.
Well, I have a printing press. I just picked up Ink Today.
Mm. Tell me about that. Same for your...
Just for the little, printer at home that everyone has.
Yeah.
But before I became a writer-editor, I was a videographer, and then before that, radio. But I did a video once for the, the Midwestern Independent Books. And they had a big thing in those days at Butler Square. And there they had people, I remember from an interview talking about in the old days, they'd have a mimeograph in the kitchen and, self-publishing. I suppose this was in the 60s, 70s was really, kind of primitive, but still people could do it. But now it's so easy.
Well, the big player, the thing that really changed the whole industry, of course, was Amazon, but not in the way people think. First of all, Amazon did not invent the ebook. If we want to go back about a dozen years ago, even earlier, the first ebooks were published by Sony. And they made the same mistake with books that they made with the Betamax. For those of you who are not familiar with the Betamax, many, many years ago when videotapes were in their relative infancy, you could either buy a VHS, which was the standard version of a video recording. You know, so you buy your movie on video or you'd rent it on video. Or you could buy the Betamax version, which the specs were all different. That was very much like Macs versus PCs. And Sony made the mistake back then to try to corner the market with Betamax. And so they had half the market for a while, and then they had 48%. And then it's a downward slide from there until the Betamax has disappeared. And then, of course, the VHS, which was the other format, also disappeared in favor of compact discs. Well, Sony made the same mistake with ebooks. They started putting out ebooks long before Amazon was available, long before the company started. But people weren't buying them because you had to first buy a Sony reader, and then you had to buy the Sony ebook. And they were hoping to be able to grow that.
They didn't learn their lesson from the videotape.
That's exactly right. They did not, which is hard to believe, but so be it. So what Amazon did that was so different. People think that Amazon invented the ebook. They did not. The ebook technology was available long before Amazon came along.
And just like Apple didn't invent the user interface.
Exactly right. And so what Bezos, what his big insight was, is that it's about distribution. And it's not about, even though tech is what's behind it, it's about how do you help people learn about something and how do you make the buying easy. So he understood. He could have actually been putting out the Kindle ebooks many years before he did. But what he understood, which was, I would argue, a stroke of marketing genius. By the way, you could easily take me aside and I could go up, down, and sideways about how we need to watch Jeff Bezos because he is trying to conquer world commerce and he's succeeding. And we need to be very careful because he will wind up controlling world commerce if we're not watching him and reining him in. So
he's one of those billionaires we got to keep an eye on.
Well, there are plenty of billionaires who don't need eyes kept on them, and I don't have any objection to him having the money. But he really is looking to control world commerce, and that's never a good thing when it's in the hands of one person.
So he doesn't need to run for president; he has higher aims.
Well, actually, he literally does because he's thinking in terms of populating other worlds and so on. You can read about this online. But in any case, so I want to make clear, I'm not a Bezos groupie. But he did have this key insight, which was in order to sell ebooks, you first need to build the infrastructure for selling print books. So his first thing was, of course, the first products that he sold were books. So he established first this online bookstore. So first he had to change the buying habits of readers.
First kill off independent bookstores.
Well, you know, curiously, he didn't. What he did was he changed the whole book-selling industry because 60% of books are now published, 60% of the books purchased are through Amazon.
Through Amazon?
Yes. Yes.
Not even other online?
No, people use other online and people use brick-and-mortar stores, of course. But he transformed the industry by creating, first of all, the online bookstore. Then, of course, it became an online place to buy anything, you know, this giant mall, as it were, online. But here is the difference. He understood that first what he would sell was a combination of low price, large inventory. You don't have to leave home. It's not taxable. So, you know, so all these benefits to buying a book online. And then you could, as an add-on, have swift delivery. So he was selling all these things, and it was a great combination. All that was necessary to create ebooks. And you'll see where I'm going in light of your original question.
So he had this in mind when he started selling books?
Absolutely. So once you have all that infrastructure in place, because first you have to change people's buying habits, in the same way that Sears and Montgomery Ward changed people's buying habits over a century ago. Remember, people used to all go into a store. But then the big catalogs back in the late 1800s understood that if you could get people to buy things from a catalog via mail order, it would be more convenient. It would save them time.
Sears and Sawbucks.
It was Sears, Roebuck, and then Montgomery Ward.
Yeah, Monkey Wards.
Monkey Wards, right. And there was the Spiegel catalog after a while as well. So what Bezos understood was first you have to change the buying habits. You have to get people to order products from their home computer instead of from going to a store And now there are still good reasons to go to a bookstore, which is why bookstores still exist. Are there fewer of them? Yes, they had to adapt. But nevertheless, there's a place for them, and many of them are doing well. And in fact, Amazon has opened its own brick-and-mortar stores.
In Seattle?
Yes, with the plan to open them all over the country. But here is the point that I'm getting to, is that first he changed the buying habits, and then he released the e-books. And what he said to people was, how would you like to have the same book, but instead of having to wait a day or two, you would have it at your fingertips within seconds, and at a lower price? And that was what needed to be built, was not the technology, but the change in the buying habits, and then to be able to offer the e-book as a better alternative to something that people were already doing. So that was the actual genius step that he made.
I think I'm a good example because I bought books online for years and never even thought of an e-book, but now I'm buying e-books left and right.
And so what Bezos did in setting this up was suddenly he created an entirely separate line of normal products, that is e-books, as opposed to what Sony was selling was a line of specialty products. In other words, Sony was selling not even Barbies with clothes, because you can't put Barbie clothes on anything but a Barbie, right? Because Barbie's too popular, but I don't know.
They don't fit on Ken.
Yeah, and they don't fit on a rag doll. Okay, so Sony did not understand that you need to make this a standard thing as opposed to a specialty thing, and that's what Jeff Bezos understood. So then he built deliberately on top of that was a platform to make it very, very easy to self-publish, because if you have the infrastructure already in place for delivering books to people in both print form and ebook form, which is what Amazon is, and there's other platforms as well that enable you to do it very, very simply, easily, and quickly. He understood that. So the next place for him to go was to enable people to self-publish. It's gone through various names. It was CreateSpace for a while. It had some other name before CreateSpace. Now it's called Kindle Direct Publishing, but that's a misnomer. They do print books as well as ebooks. And there are competitors. BookBaby does the same thing. Ingram Spark, which used to be called Lightning Source, does the same thing. And so if you have a book that you would like to get out there for very little cost, we're talking just a few $100, you can put this into the distribution system through one of these three. In other words, you would have a book, you'd spent a few $100, you could do it for $400 if you were careful, and what you would get is, on Amazon and all the major online retailers, your book will be available in both print book and ebook form, and this is also because of the rise of what we call print-on-demand or POD technology, where a very, very high-end laser printer can print one copy of your book that looks like it came off a printing press, and it will do it in under a minute. So you have this combination of technology, access, distribution. And Bezos saw how to unfurl all these step by step. And so what that means is, I'm coming back full circle here, was that in 1705 or thereabouts in England, if you had a printing press, all you did was walk into the, I don't know how many bookstores London had, they probably had 20, 25 at that point, you'd walk into that store and go, I have a book, would you please sell it? I mean, I guess back to that point, bookstores were in their infancy, right? And so all you had to do was live in London, own a printing press. Now, it was still expensive, okay. Or you knew someone with a printing press, right? But printing presses were not that common, they were expensive. And so we're now back to where we were in the sense of, well, now anybody who happens to have written a book and who has access to the technology automatically has access to many of the distribution points. Back then it was just the bookstores in London, right? You couldn't go to the Midlands and sell a book unless you were an itinerant person with a cart selling books out of the back of your cart. Although that could work too, Walt Whitman made a fortune carrying books in his bag and walking around and getting people to pay $5 a copy for Leaves of Grass. So it could be done. All I'm saying is that we have returned back to where we were in the 1700s, except that back then you had to be a wealthy person to be able to afford to print a book, And now all you need is $400 or $500.
And the ability to write a book.
Indeed. But, you know, sometimes that gets hired out. That's what we ghostwriters do. So it's been a wonderful democratization to be able to have all these books. But the result of any democratization also is that you wind up with all these products, that it's a bewildering array. There's immense competition. And it's the difference between now having hundreds and hundreds of TV channels, or when I was young, if you lived in most metropolitan areas, you had 4 or 5 channels. And just to be fair, when we had 4 or 5 channels, the world did not end. And now that we have hundreds, the world is not ending because we have 400 or 500 channels. You know, it's different, and it's better in some ways, and it's worse in some ways. But I wanted to say that in one sense it's new, and in another sense it's very, very old, what's happened for us.
Well, I remember it wasn't that long ago, you know, once again, as a ghostwriter, and people would say, should I self-publish or should I find a publisher? And then one of the pros and cons was, well, if you find a publisher, then it's easier to get it sold in a bookstore. But now who cares about bookstores?
Well, I mean, it all depends on, how do I say this? It's a little bit like the question, should I be strict with my child or should I be lenient with my child? And the answer, of course, is, well, find out about, depends on your child. I know lots of people who should have been raised strictly and weren't. And I know plenty who should have been raised leniently and weren't, and vice versa. Those who should have been raised leniently and were, I should have been raised leniently, and I was, and I'm forever grateful for that. If I had been raised strictly, I would be in jail or dead.
Okay,
I would
have. But you turned out.
Well, I did, but it was because I needed to be leniently raised, and I was.
Tell me how this metaphor applies to books.
Well, in other words, when people ask, should I self-publish or should I find a publisher? And this is exactly the question that people come to me with as a writing and publishing consultant all the time. And the answer is, it's not a general question. It's a specific question to the book, to the, you know, to what's in the book, to who your audience is, to what your definition of success is, what you're trying to achieve. And so I'm always going to work backwards with the person from what they hope to achieve, what their definition of success is. So if somebody's saying, well, what I really want to do is that this book is very, very important to me. I want to get into as many hands as possible. I want to see it very widely distributed. And if, in fact, it has a wide audience and it's a good book, then you should be taking it to a traditional publisher. That said, and then people will ask me, well, a big publisher or a small publisher, the answer to that is whoever will do the best job with the book. And, of course, whoever is also willing, because it's always a crapshoot. The question is always specific to the person, the book, the audience, and the goals. If somebody says, well, you know, I'm a professional in this field, I'm trying to build my business, and they're less concerned with the number of units sold, but they want to build their credibility, and they have a niche market, a very niche subject that they want to help teach people about, it may be wiser to self-publish. And even then, it's not necessarily either or. Many people will first self-publish, and then after the book has done well, they turn around and sell it to a traditional publisher. And I also know some who have originally traditionally published and then requested to take it out of print and then self-published. So it's not just a question of what are you hoping to achieve with the book, who's your audience, what's the book, and what are your goals. It's also, what are those right now? In other words, those can change over time.
Wow, we're talking about books with Scott Edelstein, the book guy. I guess he's a writing and publishing consultant, but he also does writing, editing, ghostwriting, and partnerships. Or what did you say?
Collaborations.
Okay. And we're going to take a break right now. We'll be back with Synapse Think Tank of the Air right after this.
Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
And we're back on Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. I'm Steve LeBeau on a field trip today in South Minneapolis in Uptown, glamorous Uptown, at the home of Scott Edelstein, a book guy and a former literary agent. I understand that many publishers, and it's like the bigger you are, the more you require that an agent comes to you, not just the author knocking on their door. How has that changed? Well, let me frame it this way. It seems to me that book publishing has kind of gone the same way as Hollywood. Instead of making, you know, 10 movies for $10 million each, they'd rather make a blockbuster for $100 million. And it seems like a lot of the book publishers, they're going for blockbusters too rather than doing a lot of books. Is that wrong or what?
Actually, the way you framed it is right in more ways than you can imagine. So let me parse it out. Okay. Well, first of all, Hollywood literally owns the biggest book publishers. And by that I mean ABC is the same, let's see, ABC and I've lost track of this, but NBC is also Viacom. It's also, I believe, Sony Pictures and Columbia Pictures. No, CBS is Columbia Pictures, and it's also one of the major book publishers. The point is that back in 10 or 15 years ago, there was this huge conglomeration of the media, so that there are now five major book publishers, they're called the Big Five. They're giant book publishers. They're multi-billion dollar organizations. They have hundreds of imprints. And
is that where Hillary Clinton went for her book?
Oh, of course, of course. But
and Michelle Obama.
Yes. But that said, I want to make the distinction between Hollywood and film, because you didn't talk about the film industry. You said Hollywood. So what has evolved over the last 15 years, really the last 20, is movements in two opposite directions, one that's democratizing and one that is about sort of codification. So at the very top, and by top I just mean size. I don't necessarily mean quality, and I don't even mean necessarily success. But at the top in book publishing now, we've got these five giant organizations, which are all owned by much larger conglomerates. So Harper is this giant publishing conglomerate, but it is owned by the guy who owns Fox News, the Murdoch organization, right? Then you have Macmillan, which is many, many, many different book publishers, and these are all over the world, which are owned by the Robert Maxwell organization. Then there is there's Hachette, which is many other book publishers and other media groups. So the whole point is there's these five giant media conglomerates. Bertelsmann is the biggest one. You've probably never heard of Bertelsmann, but one of the toes on that body is Penguin Random House, which is the largest book publisher in the world.
Heard of that one.
Yeah. So, and Penguin Random House has hundreds and hundreds of imprints and operating in a gazillion different countries. Mm. So yes, there has this been conglomeratization at the very top. That said, in book publishing, there's still tons of little operations at the middle and bottom. The fact that there was this buying spree about 10 years ago of all these publishers being merged into one, number one, it doesn't mean that the individual imprints don't have their own personalities anymore. Some have lost their personalities, but some have kept them. And it doesn't mean they don't operate independently. Some don't, some do. But even aside, I mean, if you were to drive down a suburban boulevard, you would see all these fast food restaurants, right? So there have been, over the past 50 years, the growth of fast food. But that doesn't mean that they've taken over restaurants, right? There's still corner pubs and bistros and lots of restaurants that are just individual restaurants that are doing great, and then there's small chains of two or three or four, and it's exactly the same in publishing, is that there's large, there's medium, and there's small, and it really doesn't matter what size your publisher is. Nobody sits around and goes, oh, I'd love something good to read. I would love to get a Random House book. That's not how it works. You don't go to see, I want to see a Sony picture. I don't want to see a United Artists picture. No one cares. So it's what you're looking for if you're a writer with a book is you're looking for a publishing house that will do a good job with your book. Whether it's small, medium, or large is not the issue. Who owns it is not the issue. I mean, unless it's owned by somebody who you don't want to do business with, obviously. You might say no to that. So, and the smaller publishers banded together a couple of decades ago, about 25 years ago, they didn't have the means of distribution that the big publishers have, but now they do, because first of all, through all the online vendors, they have the same means of distribution as anyone else. But in brick and mortar stores, they have what are called distributors. So just as Harper or Simon & Schuster or Putnam will have its own sales force, so will these large book distributors. And they have names like National Book Network or Independent Publishers Group and so on. And they have exactly the same kind of sales force as Simon & Schuster would have, except they represent maybe 60 or 80 different smaller publishers. Mm. So everybody gets to compete, not everybody, but you can be a player of any size and still compete on the same playing field, which has been wonderful.
I'm wondering whether Amazon has been good for self-publishers, but is Amazon also good for small publishers?
Yes, Amazon has really been good for everybody. One of the things that people don't realize is that Amazon essentially saved the book publishing industry's butt. Just at the time when all these other media were taking up more and more cultural and sort of brain space in the individuals, Amazon came along and with a new way to sell first print books, then this new way to sell ebooks, and they completely, they made books much more accessible. And truly, they did save book publishing. And for all the nasty things I can say about Amazon, I have to give it credit for really creating a foundation so that the book industry is really solid.
Well, I think we have to give part of the credit to readers.
Indeed.
Because the book hasn't died, and so many people want to write books. And I remember I was talking to someone, a woman who was a co-founder of a nonprofit organization in college. And she and her college friend just started this thing, and it was, you know, had a lot of success. And she contacted me about writing a book. And here's this young millennial, and I said, well, why don't you just want to do a, you know, Instagram or something like that? Why do you want to do a book? And she said, well, you know, if you do a movie or a video, those things look dated after a while. But books, every time you read it, you kind of recreate it anew in your mind, and it's more permanent. And so that kind of struck me as very interesting, that here's this millennial valuing books.
Well, books have books are an absolute unique product in a bunch of ways. And here's one good example, is there are a lot of subscription websites, right? You can just subscribe and you can get whatever you want. About 5, 6, 7 years ago, the Scribd, S-C-R-I-B-D, came out. And as soon as I heard it, I thought, uh-oh, this is really going to change book publishing. In fact, it may kill it off. And what it was an ebook subscription service. So if you subscribed to Scribd, and it was like $20 a month, it was very reasonable, you would have access to all their ebooks. It was like an ebook library, and it was huge. It was millions and millions of titles. So I was thinking, wow, instead of having to go out and buy ebooks one by one and spending anywhere from a couple bucks to 15, 20, 25 bucks for some ebooks, for $20 you'd be able to read anything anytime.
It's kind of like Netflix. Instead of buying the DVD, you can just find the movie on Netflix or Hulu or something.
Well, and this was during the rise of Netflix, as it had just started its streaming service for maybe a year before. And Scribd came out, and I thought, this is it. It's the Netflix of books, and that's the end of book publishing as we know it. So when that happened, I thought, okay, brace for this. And I could not have been more wrong. It was a huge failure. People did not sign up for it. And I was so shocked by this that I started asking people. I said, so do you buy ebooks? Uh-huh. What do you spend for them? About $10 each. They all said exactly the same thing. I see. And so for $20 a month, you could have access to millions of books anytime, 24/7, be able to read them all, and as opposed to paying $10 or more for each ebook. And people, every single one said, I don't want that.
Said, why not?
That was my question, why not? I said, because I won't own the book. And I said, wait a minute. Ownership in this case is purely in your head. In other words, if you buy it, you can access it 24/7. If you subscribe, you can access it 24/7 from the same device. And they all said exactly the same, it wouldn't matter. I would only be accessing it, I wouldn't own it. And, you know, I've been in this business for decades. I thought I understood it. I was truly 100% wrong about it. And Scribed did not succeed. So there is something about a book, even when it is only this electronic thing that you're accessing, that people have a unique response to and a unique relationship with. So unique that the exact same experience, with one experience being legally designated ownership and the other experience that is exactly the same being designated as access, people will they'll in huge numbers insist on one and refuse the other.
I wonder if it's similar to kind of the dilemma I had in terms of recorded music. I mean, I've always bought records and then, you know, what was the sequence? And then tapes and then CDs. But then all of a sudden you had this proliferation of music. You had iTunes, mm-hmm. and then you had iPods, and you could have, you know, 1,000 songs in there. And the dilemma I had when it was like a cassette tape, you know, I'd like the 90 minutes, so you could have 45 minutes of music on each side. Mm-hmm. It's finite. And I would take great pride, you know, I've been a DJ as part of my career, and so I would take great pride in creating a playlist of a sequence of songs that would just be the perfect flow of music on each side of that cassette tape. And you could go through and you know, they keep playing both sides forever. And then with an iPod, there's just too many songs. It's too many. It's like, which one do I choose? And so I always get lost, and then trying to find the one you want is, you know, you got to search for it and everything. So I was overwhelmed by too many options.
Interestingly, the profession of DJ, of course, has grown with the number of options, right? Because if you're going to have a gathering, a party, a celebration, a wedding, or whatever, then you need a DJ. And in fact, because of all these,
To curate your music.
Exactly right, to curate it, to monitor the room and figure out what to do next. So that has actually provided, it has both democratized it in that anybody can get anything anytime, and professionalized it because there's so much to choose from. Here you have you want at an event a DJ who knows how to pick the right things, to be able to put them in the right order, and to be able to change them on demand. So it's like so many other things in our culture right now. It's moving in two opposite directions at once.
Oh, like politics.
Yes, and also, as I said, with book publishing, I said it's getting, there are now more than ever smaller players at the bottom, and only bottom in size, not in the bottom of quality necessarily, and fewer players at the top, again, in terms of size. And I don't think that's a perfectly okay thing. It's just different. There was a time when we worried about fast food chains taking over the world, right? And it's still plenty of good restaurants that you can go to of all sizes. Now, we may be wrong about Starbucks. They have arguably the worst coffee I have ever had, and yet they are the most popular coffee chain.
You don't like Starbucks?
I do not understand how anybody can drink it. It doesn't even taste like coffee to me. But we won't go down that road. And the good thing is, right, if you're going to control millions of people in a certain way, it's perfectly harmless to control their coffee tastes, right? It's they are not doing any harm.
Wait. What coffee do you like?
Oh, actually, I would argue that the only undrinkable coffee I've had in a long time, outside of like Chinese restaurants, is Starbucks. All the other chains seem to make good coffee, and the local places all seem to make good coffee.
You don't like dark roast?
Dark roast is fine. I just don't like Starbucks versions. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, they've obviously figured out something that appeals to a lot of people. God bless them. I'm not. How do I say this? One of the great things about commerce, and there are a lot of inherent drawbacks built into capitalism, but the biggest value, the biggest benefit of capitalism, I would argue, is it sidetracks terrible human beings into making billions instead of raising armies. So, you know, let's imagine.
It's like a pressure release.
Well, it's a cultural pressure release. In other words, we give people who want to control the world, we give them a place, a way, a means for them. Ooh, I can manipulate this, I can screw this person, I can make it up the corporate ladder. And what do they do in the end? They just run some big corporation that provides products or services, and in the end, they have to be reasonable products and services, right? So in the end...
So market regulation.
Yeah, it regulates people who otherwise, in a non-capitalist organization, would become Xi Jinping. So we've already got one Xi Jinping too many, who's turning the world's largest country into the world's worst police state, and we see that happening right now.
But how's their coffee?
They have a lot of Starbucks over there.
that's
true. But I guess what I'm saying is, you know, Howard Schultz, who I don't know. I think he's foolish to think he can be president. That said,
Howard Schultz.
Yes, yeah, is the president of Starbucks. Yeah.
Oh, he's running for president.
Well, he was talking about it at one point. At one point he was talking seriously about becoming president. Mm-hmm. The point is, what's the worst he's going to do? Is he put some coffee shops out of business? He served some terrible coffee, right? And it's not like you go to a Starbucks and there's all it's not an opium den. People are just drinking Starbucks. They're part of the place where people can meet and so on. He's not doing a lot of harm to the world.
It could be worse.
Could be way worse. And also, for all of you who love Starbucks coffee, enjoy your Starbucks coffee. That you're not doing anyone any harm. It isn't bothering me. Enjoy your coffee. Interestingly, by the way, have you seen who's starting to give Starbucks a run for their money?
No.
Dunkin' Donuts, who now they've rebranded themselves as Dunkin'. If you go to Massachusetts, Dunkin' Donuts is insanely popular. I mean, I've seen a line going all the way down the block waiting for Dunkin' Donuts to open. And there's you think Starbucks is ubiquitous. Go to Massachusetts and look at Dunkin' Donuts. And
I don't have to go there in St. Paul. At the end of our street, they put in a Dunkin' Donuts. Yeah.
So they're going to compete with Starbucks big time. And yes, their coffee's better. Definitely better.
I know their donuts are better.
Yeah. So all I'm saying here is that there's always going, and this is something I've written about in some other of my books, there's always going to be people who just want as much power and control and money, and they just want to be king of the hill. And one of the, truly, the biggest unmentioned, unseen, and often overlooked benefit of capitalism, which has a ton of faults, is that it gives these folks a path where they do little or no harm. I mean, we've certainly seen the ones that do harm, right? Terrible polluters and or people who are making genuinely terrible products. But usually the market weeds out most of the terrible products, with the exception of Starbucks coffee. But even though it's terrible, it just tastes terrible. It's not giving anybody cancer. I mean, it's a perfectly healthy product, right?
Well, I'm a big coffee fanatic, and I enjoy reading all the scientific articles that say how coffee is good for you.
Yeah, coffee's good for you. So I guess what I'm saying is, God bless Starbucks. It's all good in the end. Now, Howard Schultz, if somehow he were to be elected president, he would be a terrible president. What can I tell you? But he thinks he might. He had evidently thought he could be a good president. Well, one should know better about what their strengths and weaknesses are, and I would be an utterly incompetent president, not to mention senator, congressman. We could go pretty far down that list before we got to any public position where I might be competent. And I'm aware of that. I just don't think, geez, I had some good ideas, and I'm a hell of a marketer. I could be president. So to come back to where you started with Hillary Clinton and Michelle Obama.
I forgot all about that.
is that... Yes, what many of the imprints at the largest publishers have turned into is ways to extend already existing blockbuster brands. And so if you are a celebrity, you are already a blockbuster brand, okay? And so be it. The thing is, you don't have, if you're a writer, it doesn't mean you're being pushed out of the industry. It does mean you're being pushed out of a lot of the largest publishers. But who cares? I mean, truly, when you buy a house...
You can go to Dunkin' Donuts.
You can go to Dunkin' Donuts. You can go to a small coffee shop, and you can brew your own. So there's lots of different options.
You don't have to be Hillary.
Well, you don't have... You may have to be Hillary to get a book deal with certain publishers. Right, but you don't have to be Hillary to get a book deal.
Okay. Yeah. Well... Boy, talking about books and coffee here with Scott Edelstein. Gosh, I just hadn't heard people that didn't. I know people don't like Starbucks just because of that racial incident they had,
sure.
But not because of the coffee taste. Anyway, Steve LeBeau here with Synapse Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back right after this.
Synapse. Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
And we're back on Synapse Think Tank of the Air in a field trip to South Minneapolis, the abode Shea Edelstein, I guess. I was talking here with Scott Edelstein, who has a background in books, publishing, writing, editing, ghostwriting, and your former literary agent. And, you know, I've written a lot of stuff. I've probably ghostwritten more than a dozen books and then, you know, all these other things. But I've never considered myself a literary person. It seems like when you put the word literary, it's like some sort of fancy writing that's not the same as journalistic writing, which is my niche. So how does literary writing differ from just the journalism writing?
That's a great question, because to answer it, you actually have to go back to the origins of book publishing in America. Because for really up until the mid-1800s, or 1830 or thereabouts, the British, which were of course the center of English language publishing at the time, they thought of the Americans as just a bunch of uncouth people. We were all hillbillies.
They still think that.
Well, some of them still do think that. And of course, you know, every culture has its share of whatever you want to call them. Mountain men, hillbillies, cockneys, rednecks, and salt of the earth, right? It's just, you know, people who are not urbane. But whatever you want to call them, they look down on us. And strangely, they thought we couldn't write literature. They thought we could just write sort of, they didn't have Tarzan yet, but just silly stuff, just unimportant.
Like the Declaration of Independence.
Exactly right. And so, believe it or not, American literature was deliberately invented. If you go back to 1830s, 1840s, and you look at a guy, his name was Evert, I cannot pronounce it as a Dutch name, Duyckink. I believe, Duyckink. I don't know how the Dutch would pronounce it. I mean, he was an American, but it's the name goes back to Holland. And he worked for the company called Wiley and Putnam. And Wiley and Putnam were Mr. Wiley and Mr. Putnam, and they eventually broke apart. And we still have the publisher Wiley, and we still have the publisher Putnam. They're separate organizations now. And he said, you know what? Let's show those Brits that we can write real literature. And Putnam thought it was a good idea. So they said to him, okay, your job is to build a library of American literature. And that's what it was called. It was called the Library of American Literature. And it served its purpose. Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote for it. He coached a guy named Horatio Bridge to write a book for it. I think Horatio Bridge was the first book in the series. And it was a series. It was kind of like the Franklin Mint issuing one book after another, and they were all published with similar bindings, and they were made to look classy.
To prove that Americans could write literature.
Exactly right. And it worked. And the thing about Duyckink is he knew everybody. He was the center. He was a very, very interesting guy. He was not narcissistic. He knew everybody, but he wasn't a bon vivant. He just wanted to publish good books. He wanted to get people out there. And so he was kind of like Maxwell Perkins of his time. He was perfectly happy to do all this in the background, which is why most people have never heard of him. But he literally created out of nothing. Of course, the authors were still there, right? But he was the one who put literature on the map, who said, look, Americans can create literature, and here's some really good books. That said, if you were to trace what we call commercial publishing in this, you know, the genre publishing, science fiction, horror, things like that, the gothic novels and so on, if you trace those back, they all go back to Poe. Hmm. Now, if you were to take literary publishing and trace that back, they all go back to Poe. Okay, because Edgar Allan Poe was an enormous literary figure. He was a literary giant, and he was simultaneously, he edited all these literary journals, and he was writing this very literary stuff and writing this very commercial stuff. So everything winds up what we call literary, and there's no clear definition of it. There's no clear definition of commercial. Just as like when you go to...
They don't have a different set of adjectives.
No, but I will tell you this, that now what has just started to happen, and in fact the book about it has not yet come out, but a couple of writers figured out, well, let's see what makes for a best-selling novel. Let's digitize it. And so they fed 5,000 novels into an algorithm that they created. And what it turned out was a list of what of exactly what a best-selling novel is likely to have. It's got to have the word need in it a lot. The protagonist has to be a strong female who's an outsider. They have this whole list of things. And so they have a book coming out from St. Martin's next year called The Bestseller Code, in which they describe it all. And they're not saying that if you follow this, it will work 100% of the time. They're saying that these are the things that are common to a fiction bestseller. And they're also not saying, don't get rid of your editors, for God's sake. Don't replace people with an algorithm. All we're saying here is this is a tool. And these are things that have... that are more likely to work. And when they fed...
So if you happen to think of a strong woman who's an outsider, that's a good thing.
Yes. And in fact, the first novel using that algorithm is coming out... I mean, a lot of people have self-published using that algorithm, but it's coming out next year also, called Bright Star is the title. So it'll be coming out next year. Mm. And then there is a company called Callisto Media. Their actual publishing company name is Rock Ridge Books, I believe. Yeah, Rock Ridge Books. And what they do is they use algorithms to see what people are Googling. Mm. And then they take the keywords that people are Googling, figure out what people are asking about, where there is no book, and then they hire somebody to write it. And it's been very successful.
Really? So do you have the list?
Well, I don't, but you can just go to Rock Ridge Books or Callisto Media. I think it would be Rock Ridge Books, and look at what they're publishing. And the one I first stumbled on was High Conflict Divorce for Women. Mm. There's already a book called High Conflict Divorce, but it's not for women. There was
for strong women.
Who knows? They're doing a book on basic meditation. There's only like 150 of them already, but guess what? That's what people were Googling, so they decided they would do one. So it all remains to be seen. It's all just another tool. It's not going to in any way get rid of editors or get rid of readers' choices. And the people behind it are not trying to do that. They're just saying, look, it's just another tool in the toolbox. So that's an interesting thing that's starting to happen now, is instead of everything being just human judges. I mean, as you've seen, it's starting to happen in hiring, right? There are algorithms that are used to help people hire. But if you look at what Malcolm Gladwell has written on that, he says people are really, really, really bad at hiring. They tend to hire somebody who reminds them of themselves. They tend to not hire well.
You know how bad we are.
Well, I mean, leave it this way. If I wanted to hire somebody as a ghostwriter, I'd want to hire somebody like me. If I wanted to hire somebody for almost any other job in the world, I would not want someone like me. And so hiring someone like me would probably be a really stupid decision for most of the hires. Okay, so...
So, now, all these algorithms... You're a person.
I am, as far as I know, yeah.
So how did you start out as a writer, editor, literary book person?
Good question. Well, a couple of ways. I always wanted to write. I started writing when I was about 11. So that was something I always wanted to do, and I always wanted to publish and started doing that when I was 16. But
You published at 16?
Yeah, but people have published at younger ages. I mean, you see kids' books written by kids, and yeah. But what happened was, and I really need to do a shout-out on this. I'm 65. I was 18 in 1972. The period from 72 to about 84 was a golden age of opportunity in this country. And I have to qualify that and say, at least if you were a white person, although it was certainly much better than it had been if you were a dark person. Nevertheless, people were open to all kinds of different things back then. And so it is much, much, much harder now for a young person to do something unique and have other people get behind you than it was, in my opinion, back when I was young.
So you published, what did you publish?
Short stories and magazines. I was interested in like science fiction, mystery, that kind of thing. And then back then, you could publish actual real stories in men's magazines. In other words, it wasn't just pictures of nude women. It was, there were a whole bunch of them. I mean, I stopped by the time I was 19, but what were they called? Like Swank and Adam and things. They were like second-rate playboys. Okay. And
not quite GQ.
No, they weren't GQ. But back then, you know, actually Playboy and Penthouse were considered, like Stephen King published a lot of his first stories in a magazine called Cavalier, which was another one of those second-rate playboys. I mean, I haven't looked at one in God knows how many years, but that was a place where you could publish short stories. Mm. And that's where Stephen King got his start. But then when I got to Minneapolis in 78, just out of getting out of college, I started, the loft was very young at that point. It was just a room with some chairs. They didn't even have a blackboard. The loft, of course, is the big writer's center in Minneapolis.
Where did the loft begin?
Well, it started, I believe, above Saverin's bookstore in Dinkytown, but then it had moved above a cafe on Chicago Avenue.
Right, I remember. That's when I first remembered it.
Yeah. But there was very little for writers. There wasn't much of a writing community, and people didn't know things. So I pitched some courses, some extension courses to the U in writing and publishing. And so I just pitched some ideas and started teaching classes around town, both in writing and in publishing. And it turned out that, you know, there was nowhere to go if you wanted information on this. There were books, a couple of books, a couple of writers' magazines, but they didn't give you much info.
So you became the place to go.
Exactly right. And that may be the reason when I say that people had many more opportunities then. I don't think it had anything to do so much with the culture, so much as just what had not yet had a chance to develop. You know, I don't think people were in some way better or different. It's just that back then we were going from a culture in which there weren't a lot of options, and people were starting to push out these options. People were starting to appear and fill niches that had long been unfilled, and now there are many, many more niches, but they tend to be already filled. Do you see what I mean? At least in terms of being able to make a living at it. So for many years, I did some combination of teaching, writing, working one-on-one with people, and then after a time, did some literary agenting. I still do some of that, but I'm now 65, so I'm letting my clients. I'm not taking on new people, and I'm letting the current clients age out.
So don't call Scott.
Well, don't. In terms of if you're looking for a literary agent, I'm not taking on new people, and you know I'm letting that list of clients keep shrinking. But I'm still doing all the other things. I'm just doing less of it as I'm getting older. And the balance has had to shift over the years because as things have changed. And then there was a time, I don't know, about 20 years ago, I just got sick of running my own business, and I worked for the county as a public policy writer for a year. And then I taught in Hamlin's MFA program for 11 years, but that was mostly part-time. But for, I can't remember, it was a year or 2 years I taught full-time. I think it was a year, year and a half, I can't, whatever. And because I just wanted a break. But it's always been some combination of that. And I still do it. I still enjoy it. I'm starting to slow down now, now that I'm getting old. But yes, I filled a niche that was unfilled. And strangely, then there are several other people doing things that are similar to me, which is good. We need more people doing this kind of advising. But especially now that the book publishing culture has changed so much, there's a lot more misinformation out there, a lot more nonsense, and a lot of people are like people who write conferences and so on, are making money out of helping writers feel small, and that is not the case. We should be making writers more successful, more accessible. And
what do you mean making them feel small?
Well, I don't want to go too far down this road. That could be a whole other discussion, but do we have 2 more minutes?
Okay. We have 2 more minutes.
Okay. So here's what's happened in our culture in general. When, this is another reason why I had it a lot better than people nowadays. During the 70s and early 80s, things were very non-hierarchical. Again, if you had dark skin, well, there was still racism, and so there was a hierarchy if you weren't white. We still have not outgrown that. That said, we were outgrowing it somewhat, and somewhat very deliberately at that time as well. Outside of that, though, we were the sense around in the whole culture was you could try something new and you didn't have to kowtow to people. Nowadays, what happens is there's big business in helping people continue to feel small. And this is what happens in a lot of writers' conferences, and it's why I don't speak at writers' conferences anymore. I used to do that regularly. Is the whole setup that they have is that here are these famous writers, or here are these agents or these editors, and they're these really important, powerful people. And if you pay us a lot of money, we'll get you an audience with them, and you can kowtow to them, and maybe if you're really lucky, they'll read your stuff. That is so wrong. It is so untrue. It is so inhuman. Because in fact, you can be pitching to these people directly without meeting them, without paying a fee to the conference, without any of that stuff. But somehow our culture has gotten into this sense of haves and have-nots, powerful and unpowerful. And people will pay a lot of money to be told, you have no power, give us money, and we will give you an audience with the powerful, and they may anoint you. That is 100% nonsense, and it's making the whole country smaller.
Yeah. And you're for power for the people.
Yes, except that it's power we already have. It's power we merely need to act on.
Wow. Well, that's kind of a positive note to end on here. Gosh, I feel better. I feel better. Talking here with Scott Edelstein from the writing and publishing industry. He's a consultant, writer, editor, and kind of knows a whole lot of history and a lot of industry knowledge here. Nice talking with you, Scott. I'm Steve LeBeau, your host on Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. And I'd like to also thank our producer, Dan Culhane, and to mention this is a co-production with WCCO Radio. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to Synapse. Think Tank of the Air. I'm Leo Espinosa.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.